Okay, let's bring this back to center. If we can. Wonderful. There is a there's a sign-in sheet here for confirmands. I know that's a thing, so I'll if this is needed, I'm just going to send it around one more time in case anyone did not get it that needs to. If you're not a confirmand, you don't have to sign in. You're good. All right, so this is what we're going to do today. We are talking the second part of the story. If last week Nick did the history of the Church of England from the Resurrection basically to the Reformation, I'm going to take you today from the Reformation to today. And we're going to cover all that in like 25 minutes or something ridiculous. So we're going to move kind of quickly. Last year, I have a version of this lecture that includes some cards that people work at tables. But I like how Nick has been doing it, where he has signs. And so I'm taking a page out of Nick's book. And I need, let me think, I need 9 volunteers. So I'm going to need 9 volunteers. And what you're going to have to do as a volunteer is you have to stand up here and hold a sign for us. All right? The upside is that you will not get called on for questions. Yes, all right. Jeff Allen's like, I'm in. Okay. Let me see if I can get some of these kiddos to do this. Come on, confirmands.
We're going to do a confirmand.
Yes, confirmand and mentee, I like that. All right, come on in. All right, I know, Chris, you already said you would do it. It's wonderful. I love that. All right, yes. All right, awesome. Yeah, so you just come on. If you have a sign, come on up. Stand in line. Come on, what do you do? Sit here by yourself? You got this. Okay. Yes, I love it. Okay, very good. Yes, I love this. Yes. That's it. Do it with a buddy. I love that. That's awesome. Okay. Oh, I have an extra Michael Curry. I need one more. What? Yes. Wait, Patrick or Stuart, what, you guys can arm wrestle for it.
No.
I like how both of you volunteered him. He'll do it. Well done. Okay. So here's what I need. So everybody, hold your signs up if you have a sign. Patrick, come on down to the side. Patrick, come on down here. All right. Now, here's what I need y'all to do. Class, these are significant events in the life of the Church of England, starting at the Reformation and moving toward the present day. I need you to order them oldest to most current, okay? So let's see if we can do this real fast. What do you think? Let's take a couple of minutes. All right, so Michael Curry is down here, they're saying. So shift down, everybody. Take a step down this way. Okay, that's a give me, right? Okay. What else? Do you remember where Nick ended? Right, so maybe the Elizabethan settlement all the way at the end on this side. Oh, my God, how amazing. All right, now what? Fair enough. Let's guess, and what we're going to do is we're going to shuffle them correctly. So Jamestown, they're saying, is down here. So, yeah, come on down, Callie. Right down here. You're Jamestown Parish, yeah. Where is she? Where do you think she is? Somewhere here-ish. Okay. All right, I like that. All right, Golden. So what else? Where else do we think we are? What are we at? Christ Church, Philadelphia, before the American Revolution. Okay. Acts movement after the Civil War. All right. Richard Hooker's to the left. How far to the left? So kind of here-ish? All right, so they're saying, Richard Hooker, how about you? You're going to be down here. I heard audio of this lecture from last year, and I turned it on to find it, and it's just me saying, move Hooker here. Hooker. I'm like, I will try to refer to him as Richard Hooker. Okay, what do we think? So First American Prayer Book, where? So they're saying before the Civil War? After the revolution? All right. How are we feeling? I think that's a place to start, right? Good? What do you think? You were telling me all you're good? Okay. So, all right, so let me do this. Because I do have some slides, I'm going to have you all, we're going to part the Red Sea. I want you to, everybody take, if you're on this side, take a shuffle step that way. This side, take a shuffle step that way. Okay. Now, let's see if we can't tell this story appropriately. So, if the history of Anglicanism could be distilled into a metaphor, it's kind of an hourglass that finds its center at the Elizabethan settlement. You remember all the stuff with King Henry and the wives and how he was either annulling marriages or murdering them in alternate fashion, right? We are not great. Our story is a story of resurrection and redemption. We are not a pure church. And so what you see in the Church of England is God taking something gross and making something beautiful out of it. So that's how we started. But remember, after Henry dies, he has basically been hedging his soteriological bets, meaning he has Roman Catholic last rites read to him, but sets his son Edward up, the male heir he's finally trying to get, with Protestant tutors. And so at Henry's death, his archbishop, Thomas Cranmer, is finally set free to go and do the liturgical work that he's been wanting to do, and he drafts and writes the first prayer book in 1549, the first Book of Common Prayer. This is a hugely significant document because it's written in English, and heretofore, you had been praying in what language if you were Roman Catholic? Latin. And so it's a prayer book in the language of the people for the people to actually read the prayers that they're praying. So the first version is 1549. It gets revised again a couple years later in 1552. And we're kind of off to the races as a people with a book of prayer. Now, pretty soon thereafter, Elizabeth is the one that really locks down the Church of England in a way that makes it stay. Like, we're only here because of her. We were definitely founded by a wily monarch and a liturgical genius, Thomas Cranmer, but it is Elizabeth that allowed us to remain our own. And it's because at the Elizabethan settlement, she said basically this, whereas the fighting before her time had been between Protestants and Catholics, it had been about this kind of, big time wrestling with, are we going to be Protestant? Are we going to be Catholic? Are we loyal to the Pope? Are we loyal to the King? How's it going to go? Under Elizabeth, finally what she says is, okay, stop. We are not going to do this anymore. And I am going to make some definitive declarations here in this Elizabethan settlement. And what she says is it basically contains three different things. It has the act of supremacy, where she says, okay, here's the deal. I am head of church and state. Queen, church, all together, that's me. Also, she passes the act of uniformity that says, we will pray with the prayer book Thomas Cranmer wrote in 1549, revised 1552. So 7 years before this. So we are going to use the prayer book. That is going to be our standard for worship, okay? And if there's any discrepancy about questions of doctrine, we will use Cranmer's 39 Articles of Religion, which he had written about the same time he drafted the prayer book. And they range, the articles, they're still printed in the back of our prayer book, and they cover everything from like the means and method of salvation, theology of the Eucharist, which books we think should be in the Bible, which ones we don't. But there's only 39 of them, actually cut down from 44, because we're Episcopalians, we're keeping the bar low, so we can all get over it. And so basically, the church starts this way. Now, I want to point something out to you. If the first prayer book is in 1549, right, and the Elizabethan settlement is in 1559, we've got 10 years, okay, or so, where the Church of England is praying before they've locked down any doctrine, all right? And this is really important because our way of being Christian is formed by the way we pray. You're going to hear when we teach you the prayer book a phrase, lex orandi, lex credendi. What we pray is what we believe. The way of belief is the way of prayer. Because we started as a people with prayers, and then the doctrine was built out of the way we were worshiping. It didn't start with doctrine, and then they wrote liturgies to fit the doctrine. Does that make sense? And that's a unique thing about how we are. I'm seeing a lot of quizzical looks. Maybe I should have left that out. We'll cover it again when we get to the prayer book. But it's important just historically to note that the articles are written after we're praying with the book, okay? So that's the Elizabethan settlement, and that's kind of where we go. Now, under Elizabeth, the British Empire experiences vast success. It becomes an empire, right? And what's the old adage of the British Empire? The sun never sets on the British Empire. Why is that the adage that you hear? Because England does what empires do. They colonized. And so they sent their people out all over the world. And because the church and the state are the same thing, and because the Church of England is the people of England at prayer, wherever people, the British Empire went, so their prayer book went as well. And so it went all over the world. One of the places it went was where? Right here, right? The Americas, what were then called the Americas, the colonies. And so what we have, is the British Empire. Now, oh man, I'm like out of order. I was thinking I could just kind of roam and do this. Maybe I need to not try to mess with my slides and mess with the things as well. Okay, so here's what, this is what's important. While the colonizing process is happening and the church spreading, Elizabeth faces a new threat. Her threat is not Catholic influence on the church. The new threat is this virulent stream of Protestantism that has cropped up called the Puritans. And the Puritans are people that believe very, very strictly that only what is included in the Bible should be included in Christian worship. So everything that had any sort of Romish, a whiff of papacy, was to be excised from the church, okay? That means art. That means music. That means vestments. That means Gothic church buildings. All of this stuff should be read right on out. And so they're coming at Elizabeth, and they're challenging her authority and her act of supremacy and uniformity. And so she calls on Richard Hooker, Cambridge Don, former rector of Temple Church, and says, Richard, I need you to help me out. All I have are the 39 articles of religion. I need more than that to deal with the Puritans, because Cranmer was writing in a different time for a different context. Help me out. So Hooker goes, and Richard Hooker goes, and basically helps draft a theological schema for the Church of England that addresses the concerns of the Puritans but maintains the distinctives that Cranmer wrote into our liturgies through the articles. And this kind of way that he found, we started calling the via media. Have you heard this? This middle way. It's central to Anglicanism. And it really was birthed out of this pushback from the Puritans. So what you have is Hooker writing this magnum opus called The Laws of Ecclesiastical Polity. There he is. He finishes it in 1581. It is nigh unreadable, right? Are you offering this to me? Do I sound like I'm dry-throated? I'm gonna keep drinking that coffee though, because I need the caffeine, I think, more. Because I look at us. Like, they're never gonna, if I stop, they're gonna kill me. Thank you though. So the Laws of Ecclesiastical Polity is this work that basically is built on Aristotelian philosophy. It's all about natural law. So it's kind of like just as there are natural laws that govern the natural universe, so those laws can affect the way we order our church. And so he puts together, based on Cranmer's articles, things that are really central to our life together, like what we believe happens in baptism, what we believe happens in the Eucharist, the role of the church in regard to salvation, society. Hooker is the guy that does this. So if Cranmer is kind of the guy that gets the ball rolling, it's Richard Hooker that really is our founding theologian. If we had one, if we had a founding theologian, it would be him. And so he was instrumental in making us kind of theologically who we are. Now, I've had to read of the laws of ecclesiastical polity because I went to seminary. None of you should have to read it. But it's important that you know what it is, and that if you want to spell laws, you spell it with an E. Okay. So as the British Empire's colonization efforts spread out with this theological system, you find, of course, that they reach the Americas. Does anybody want to guess when the first prayer book service was read in what is now the United States? Take a guess the year. Anybody want to guess? 1759, read when Sir Francis Drake's The Golden Hind made landfall in what is now Oregon. So give me the Golden Hind shuffled down by Richard Hooker. So you got to flip. Yeah, there you go. Nice. And so, did I flip the dates? Oh, did I say it's 15? Oh, it must be 16. I must have it wrong on my thing. At any rate, the prayer book comes out. I'll have to check the dates. Again, I'm like working without my notes here. So Anglicanism comes here, and the prayer book services are being read. This is the point. The dates are never the point for me. I got to get the dates right. But the point is that when Anglicanism starts to spread and the prayer book worship is happening, it's happening basically, it's spreading through the globe in three ways. It's showing up on private ships that have got lay people with books of common prayer that are reading services in their language. It's happening through military excursions of the British Empire that are sending priests with their military vessels, and privateer companies that are also employing clergy to go with their people, because when they get to where they're going and they're setting up colonies, they want churches, right? Now, what ends up happening in, of course, the Americas, and what is now known as the Americas, and where we are with our 13 colonies, is that the different religious groups end up being responsible and kind of taking over large parts of the culture in the colonies. So Florida and Maryland are largely Roman Catholics. That's kind of like the first religious group that shows up and settles there. New England has a lot of Puritans, right? We're familiar with this. Rhode Island's the Baptist. New Jersey has a large contingent of the Friends, which are like the Quakers. Delaware by the Lutherans, but you have Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia. They are all predominantly Church of England. And so that's why you'll find around the United States some of the oldest parishes in our country. Parishes, of course, being from our colonial efforts, not indigenous churches, that they're Episcopal churches. They're Church of England churches, right? So this includes like Jamestown Parish, which is like technically the first Episcopal church. It was Anglican then, circa 1607. So where's Jamestown Parish? Do we get you right? So you're going to flip over by the Golden Hind? Yep. Very nice. Very nice. Then you also are familiar with Christ Church Philadelphia, which was founded in 1695. Trinity Church Wall Street, you've heard of this one, right? All these churches that you're familiar with are showing up, and they're all Episcopal churches, right? Now, of course, you know Trinity Church Wall Street because who's buried there? Alexander Hamilton, right? No? Oh, I thought you'd know Hamilton. There's a musical called Hamilton. It's kind of a big deal, apparently. And they sing about his grave at Trinity Parish in Wall Street. You also have, when you kind of fast forward a little bit, when the United States builds a national cathedral, the Cathedral Church of St. Peter and St. Paul in Washington, D.C., it's an Episcopal church. Teddy Roosevelt lays the cornerstone. All right, so you have this deep interconnection of Anglican Church of England worship with the emergence of the United States. Do you see that in that way? All right, so do we got Christ Church in Jamestown? You guys are amazing. Now, everything's working great. All of the clergy that are here are, I'm going to skip this part about vestries. All the clergy that are here are doing their jobs faithfully, but part of their ordination vows meant that they had to swear allegiance to the queen or king. And so the crown is the head of the Church of England, right? And so that starts to create problems when there's this kind of issue about taxation and representation, right? And in the late 1700s. When the American Revolution happens, 3/4 of the signers of the Declaration of Independence are members of the Church of England. But after the Revolution, and when we win, and we separate ourselves from England politically, the church has to figure out, what does it mean for us to be part of the Church of England and not be connected to the crown? How do we do that? And so they start by renaming themselves, okay? And so you'll notice that in most parts of the world, churches connected to the Church of England are Anglican churches, right? Not so here. What are we called? The Episcopal Church. It's from the Greek word episkopos that means bishop. And we took it because our way of being church, it means we're governed by bishops. You don't have to do it that way. It's just how we do it. There's lots of ways to organize the church. We just happen to organize it through bishops. And so they took that name to say, we're still part of them, but through the ways that we use bishops. Which means for this church to perpetuate itself in the new world, what did they need? They needed some bishops, right? So of course, they go to the Archbishop of Canterbury and to the Church of England, and they're like, hey, could you consecrate some of our priests bishops so we can continue our church? And they, of course, said, no. Are you kidding? No, we're not doing that. Look, we just fought a war with us. We're not going to handle that. No, we're not doing that. And so they would not consecrate new bishops. And so the church is kind of stuck. What are they going to do? So what they end up doing is they take this guy, Samuel Seabury, and they send Samuel up to Scotland. Because in Scotland, the church up there, through a group called the Non-Jurors, had figured out how to be part of the Church of England, but not be connected politically to the crown anymore. And so they got the Scottish bishops to consecrate Seabury and send him back here as our first American bishop, which is really cool. And they said, here's what you have to do, though. The thing that you need to do, if we're going to do this, is you must include our structure of the Eucharistic prayer and a particular item in it called the epiclesis. Let me hear you say epiclesis. Let me hear you say epiclesis. That was amazing. That was amazing. So epiclesis is basically the moment at which the priest during the consecration of the Eucharist brings their hands out and says, make this for your people the body and blood of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. It's when we call the Holy Spirit down upon the gifts, okay? That is in our Eucharistic prayer to this day, and it's required in all our Eucharistic prayers because our Scottish forebears said, we need that in there. So is the structure of the way our Eucharist works. It's all in there from our Scottish heritage. Now, a couple of years later, we're able to mend fences with England, and they consecrate William White and Samuel Provost as bishops, and so we're kind of off and running. Now, what's interesting about that is you will find both of these represented in our iconography, because Samuel Seabury is consecrated by the church in Scotland. That's the St. Andrew's Cross. William White and Provost are consecrated in England. That's the St. George's Cross. And that is why our shield looks the way it does. It has the St. Andrew's Cross and the St. George's Cross together. And those 9 crosses there represent the 9 original dioceses that were formed together and brought together and ratified at Christ Church in Philadelphia, where Betsy Ross was a parishioner, right? Christ Church. Christ Church also in Philadelphia plays a big role because what was the first capital of the United States? Philadelphia, right? So, and why that again is not just me being erudite and uppity is because William White, okay, is the chaplain to the Continental Congress. And he is the guy that's working with all of the folks in Philadelphia to build this kind of democratic government that they put together for the United States, right? So how does our system work? We have a bicameral legislature. We have representatives from the Senate. We have representatives from the House. And they're kind of allocated by population. And they come together to do the work of our government or not do it. Insert your snarky comment here. Would you be surprised to learn that the Episcopal Church is set up the exact same way? Our general convention that's happening this summer is a bicameral legislature with bishops representing dioceses and then lay and clergy delegates elected by diocesan convention to go and represent their diocese on a whole host of matters. Small dioceses have lesser numbers here. Larger dioceses get more delegates, right? Distributed by population, and they vote on stuff. In fact, the General Convention of the Episcopal Church is the largest democratically elected body in the world, right? To govern one of the smallest denominations in this country. It is a vast bureaucracy, thousands of legislators. Unless you really like that kind of thing, you don't need to go. I've never been asked to be a delegate to convention. I'm grateful. 2 weeks of that would burn me. So, but you see the connections and the overlap between who we are and and our nation. Now, as Anglicanism progresses through, that's right, Absalom Jones, you can shuttle down. I need to move a little quicker. As it progresses through, marches through time, actually the first American prayer book shows up here. I was going to do that. I'm going to skip that. We get our own prayer book because we can't use somebody else's prayer book because Anglicanism does indigenous worship. We do worship in the language and the symbol sets of the people. So right shortly after we declare our independence, we start working on our own prayer book. It's a very important thing. We'll get to that. We'll do some of that history when we're together talking about the prayer book in a while. But the Episcopal Church, as it develops in this country, has, because of its connection with the leaders of the nation and the things that are going on, it's like part of the civic religion. It ends up being on the forefront of social causes. So Absalom Jones, first African American ordained in the Episcopal Church. I was going to tell you his story. We just had his feast day a little while ago. I don't have time. You should look him up. Amazing stuff. But here's the thing. He's ordained as a leader in the Episcopal Church, a priest. He's actually released to go and do his own church because they were segregating, like African Americans had to sit in the balcony in these churches, and everyone was like, why are we doing this? And so there was this kind of moment of realization. They ordain him, release him into ministry. Look at what year that is. In 1804, right? When was the Emancipation Proclamation? Yeah, so this is like 60 years before that happens. So you see this sort of this tendency developing in the Episcopal Church where it starts to be, and at its worst, is smug about being on the forefront of social causes. Now, when the Civil War happens in the United States, it's important to note that it is deeply traumatic, of course, to the nation. Every denomination in this country splits during the Civil War, North versus South, except for two, the Roman Catholics and the Episcopal Church. They did not separate over the Civil War, which I think is very, very powerful and profound. It talks about the commitment to bonds that hold us together. Now, after the Civil War, though, a new sort of movement that's been going on in England but got stalled coming over here because of the Civil War starts to impact the United States, and it's called the Oxford Movement. And in the early 1800s in England and then late 1800s after the Civil War here, the Oxford Movement was a movement in the church to basically re-Catholicize the faith. Because that Puritan influence had come in so hot and heavy, there had really been great pushback against anything that looked Romish at all. Anything, again, vestments, art, this sort of thing. And the Oxford Movement was a group that said, we might have thrown the baby out with the bathwater. And so they started bringing Catholic practices back into the church. Things like you know how we wear stoles when we celebrate the Eucharist, right? Nobody wore stoles in the Church of England until the Oxford movement, right? Until like the end of the 1800s, because they just wore the big black scarves, tippets. The fact that right now you have a prayer book that has us do saying the Eucharist as the principal service on a Sunday, and we have Eucharist every Sunday, that is because of the influence of the Oxford movement on this church. So it was this re-Catholicization of the faith. This man was one of the leaders of it. His name is John Henry Newman. You might know him as Cardinal Newman, because he basically became Catholic. He kept going. And so that happens from time to time. They swim the Tiber, as they say, and head back to Rome. So, but he is one of the leaders of this. Did he show up here? So Oxford movement, you're good. You're coming right down. So that's an important movement. It was Eucharistically, it kind of re-Catholicized the faith and really added to a revival of Eucharistic theology in the American church, such that that 1979 prayer book that we are using now has us celebrating the Eucharist all the time. Okay, so here's how it closes out. So in the 1960s, the Episcopal Church, leaders in most of the mainline denominations, kind of enter the social unrest of the time. And you find the leaders of, again, the mainline churches, and the Episcopal Church is one of them, kind of saying, I think that Vietnam might not be a good idea, and I think Martin Luther King Jr. might be onto something. And at that time, in that way, they are, you can kind of track it socioculturally, kind of displaced from the seat of civic power, all right? Like, they're no longer the civic religion. People talk about, and some of you remember the days when, the newspaper would call the Episcopal priest and be like, what do you think about stuff, right? And they don't do that now. Who do they call? They call evangelical leaders, because waiting in the wings to be part of the civic religion were kind of like the evangelicals and conservative Roman Catholics, right? But what happened is that trajectory that began in the 1960s in the Episcopal Church continued in terms of the Episcopal Church's self-identity as a body that is involved in social causes, right? Some of you are like, that's why I'm here. I love this place. And some of you are like, I know, it's exhausting. All of you are right, okay? But what you find over and over again in the Episcopal Church is that, like with Absalom Jones, the way that we have tended to advance that conversation inside our own polity has been through the mechanism of ordination. So the first woman that's ordained in the Anglican Communion is Florence Lee Timoy. She's a Chinese woman. That she's got these leadership gifts, and they're like, we need to have this conversation about women's ordination. Let's ordain her. Women's ordination comes into the American church by ordination. In the early 2000s, the first openly gay man, V. Gene Robinson, is consecrated as the Bishop of New Hampshire. Okay, and so ordination and the mechanism of ordination becomes this way that the Episcopal Church tends to make, engineer social conversations in its community for better and for worse. I'm not adding a value to that, I'm just stating that. And you guys know what I mean. Like, you feel that in this church at our best and at our worst. We had the first female presiding bishop, first female primate, Catherine Jeffert Shorey. She was the first one that was among all the primates of the world that was a female. And then, of course, we recently elected the Most Reverend Michael B. Curry, our former bishop, as our new presiding bishop, the first African-American to hold the office of presiding bishop in the Episcopal Church. So that's just kind of part of the identity of this denomination, right? And why you find people talking about it. It has this long kind of history that rolls back through. Does that make sense? Okay, so implications. Yeah, I'll do implications. All right, implications. We have tended to be the church of the aristocracy in this country. That is not good. It just is. That's just kind of part of our history. We've got that, again, National Cathedral is an Episcopal church. We've got connections with people that have been in varying degrees of power and authority throughout the history of the United States. That's part of just kind of our history. Recently, though, we have adopted a very rebellious, prophetic spirit. So at our best, we would be acting in the ways that the prophets would be. And we would say, hey, we've missed something. We need to call people back to God's dream and to God's purpose. And like, we've lost the gospel, you know, culturally. At our worst, though, we're just basically like snotty adolescent kids. And we're Americans that believe that we don't need the rest of the world and we can do whatever we want, right? And there's like a smugness to it. And that's absolutely part of who we are. Number three, push comes to shove, we do err on the side of bureaucracy. So you find us with people like John Wesley. Nick talked about him last week. You did Wesley last week. John Wesley is this amazing Anglican priest that's doing innovative ministry that's out of the box. We don't know what to do with it because it doesn't fit our systems, so we cut them loose. So we err on the side of bureaucracy. It does not look good on us, but we do. But we are also extremely malleable. Anglicanism can take root in lots of different cultures, and it has. We get we are very attuned to contextual expressions. Whereas in the Roman Catholic missionary efforts, Roman Catholics would show up in your country and they would set up a Roman Catholic church and you'd do the mass in Latin and all the vestments would look European and it would be like, it's like a franchise. Anglican churches went into indigenous cultures and worked really hard to produce prayer books in the language and symbol set of the people. So that's part of our value. It's why we also end up revising our prayer books. And I was just part of some conversations about that because people are like, are we in need of new enculturation or not? Okay, let's give a hand to all of our sign holders. Bravo. Harris and Dean will take your signs, and I'm going to give you a caveat. And you can all go have a seat. Take y'all seats. Thank you, sir. So here's the last point I want to make, and this is kind of personal for me. Howard Zinn is a historian, an American historian. He is considered by some an alternative historian in that he has worked his whole career to write history from the perspective of people that don't usually have their stories told. So what's the story behind the story? And in his preface to A People's History of the 20th century, he wrote a book called The People's History of the United States of America. I don't know if you've read it or not. But he says this. He says, part of his method, he says, to emphasize the heroism of Columbus, for example, and his successors as navigators and discoverers, and to de-emphasize their genocide is not a technical necessity, but an ideological choice. It serves unwittingly to justify what was done. He says, the treatment of heroes like Columbus and their victims, and the quiet acceptance of conquest and murder in the name of progress is only one aspect of a certain approach to history in which the past is told from the point of view of governments, conquerors, diplomats, leaders. It is as if they, like Columbus, deserve universal acceptance, as if they, like the founding fathers or anyone else, represent the nation as the whole. Here's why I bring this up. This is distracting. I'm just going to own it. I have just told you the history of Anglicanism in the United States from the point of view of governments, conquerors, diplomats, and leaders, as if they represent everything that was going on in the Church of Jesus Christ at the time. It's important for us to say they don't. What God is doing is always on the underside. It's always on the margins. When God is at work, it's usually among people who don't get attention, who don't have their story told. It's the way that God is working to heal the world in the underbrush, right? On the outskirts of things where people aren't paying attention. It can be easy to think that we don't have a part to play in making our church what it's meant to be and in joining God's history, because you see a presentation like this and it's kings and it's rulers and it's super smart theologians that went to cool schools and wore weird clothes like me. The weird clothes part. And that's not true. All of us are part of telling the story of the Episcopal Church right now. All of us have a part to play. And don't ever think that we can't be better than we've been. And that your participation isn't important. because you have a part to play in this. And God has called you to be here for a particular reason, for a particular purpose. Always be asking what that is and how you can participate in serving God through this church. Amen. Any questions? Thank you all so much.